Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by JVL. Good to have you back on, JVL.
Charlie, how is your hand?
You know what? The swelling is going down. I'm not sure the worst thing. For people who don't know about this, I actually took a picture of my swollen hand. It was swelled up like a dirigible after I got stung by some yellow jackets that are kind of known as the terrorist yellow jackets. Your normal bee won't bother you that much. But the yellow jackets.
Were these the murder yellow jackets?
It felt like it. I mean, it hurt. It hurt like hell. It's on my freaking mailbox. I go to open up the mailbox and it stings me. And it's like, wow, that was nasty. And of course, how nasty was it? Well, when my hand swelled up like the marshmallow puff boy, whatever.
So when you posted that picture of it, it looked like your hand and forearm were a movie prop.
Yes, it felt
it did
like
not
that.
Look real and human. That was pretty nasty.
It's kind of weird, especially when it's attached to your own body and you're looking at it. So I took a lot of Benadryl and Pepcid and all that stuff. So I felt like I slept for about 20 hours yesterday, mainly because of the Benadryl. But at least now I can. As my wife says, you can now see your knuckles again. It's which is a good thing, I guess. But man, that was nasty. I mentioned in the newsletter just to sort of apologize that I didn't have, you know, it might be thinner than usual because I really couldn't type with my right hand. It was that swollen up. Couldn't move it. So, but
get
you know,
an EpiPen. Get an EpiPen. You don't want to get stung near your face or neck if that's the sort of reaction you have to these things.
See, this is not a joke. My wife actually had multiple stings a few years ago, and she had to go to the hospital because she had the complete anaphylactic shock, and she carries an EpiPen with her all the time. I got stung about a year ago on my foot, and it swelled up pretty badly, but you know, really sort of a no big deal. So I think this is one of those cases where the more you get stung, the worse your reaction is, because this was exponentially worse than the last time. I mean, I usually don't worry about this stuff, but this was the first time I began to think, you know, if this happened again, it could be bad. So anyway, but not to worry about that. Hey, can I rant a little bit about something going on in Madison, Wisconsin?
Please do. How are they taking down the statues of all the terrible Confederate racists up in Madison?
No, I think they've lost the plot completely. Okay. So, I mean, this is just stupid and it's ugly. They tore down the statue of Lady Forward, which is kind of the symbol of the progressivism of Wisconsin. So we're going after female statues. That's number one. Number two, the protesters beat up one of the most liberal Democrats in the state, a gay legislator who took their picture, and they beat the crap out of him. Okay, so that's number two. Number three, and we're working up to this one. They tear down a statue of a guy named Hans Christian Hegg. I don't expect anyone to know that name, a Norwegian immigrant who was an outspoken abolitionist. He was a prison reformer. He was a journalist who went to fight for the Union and died in battle. And they tore his statue down and beheaded him. So this is like, guys, you know, do you have any idea what you're doing? Is this anything other than performative destruction and violence? And how do you think that's playing in Wisconsin today? This story that you vandalize these monuments and these statues, beat up legislators that have nothing to do with Black Lives Matter. It has nothing to do with police any longer. So I don't know. So to Tim Carpenter, who's the guy that got beat up, and I've known Tim for a long time. He says he may have had a concussion or a fractured nose in addition to a bruised eye and sore ribs and back. And he says this has to stop before someone gets killed. Sad thing is, I'm on their side for peaceful demonstrations. And a gay progressive Democratic senator served 36 years in the legislature, and they still beat the crap out of him.
Well, can I give you the silver lining of all of this?
Yeah, please.
Because stuff like this gives a real off-ramp for everybody in the Democratic Party to suddenly crack back on rioters and looters. there has long been a, well, gosh, we got to be careful. We, you know, if we say nasty things about the rioters, then some people could interpret it as us being against the protesters, and we want to be understanding, and there are root causes, and yada, yada, yada. Stuff like this makes it super duper easy for anybody who considers themselves a liberal or progressive in good standing to say, these people ain't with us. These people are nothing but violent criminals, and we ought to throw the book at them.
Yeah, I would hope that that's the case, because it's taken a long, I mean, you have to understand that Madison, which is what, you know, 36 miles surrounded by reality, has always been a different world than the rest of the state. And the mayor there has taken a very laissez-faire, hands-off approach to the protesters / rioters, which is, there's a distinction here, because the rioters are just engaging in random violence. So the governor, Democratic Governor Tony Evers, who is not the strongest figure that we've ever had, says that he's open to bringing in the National Guard. We'll see whether he does. And he did issue a statement condemning the attack on Tim Carpenter, but couldn't bring himself on the other statues thing. So you're absolutely right. This is a great opportunity for them. But you are starting to see, I'm sorry, I am totally in favor of removing the Confederate statues. I mean, I'm there. I have no problem with that. But how did we lose the plot in now making this all about iconoclasm? You know, all about tearing down statues. They're actually talking about tearing down the statue of Abraham Lincoln in Washington, D.C. This is not a parody anymore. How did we go from this moment of dealing with criminal justice and racial, you know, and racial inequities to which statue should we tear down?
See, I'm in favor of removing Confederate statues. I grew up in New Jersey. I realized the other day, I've now spent more of my life south of the Mason-Dixon line than above it, which horrified me a little bit. But I'm wildly against tearing them down.
Right. Like
it ought to be a considered decision by people in positions of public power who are accountable to voters. It should not be throngs of people who just decide that, like Saddam style, they're going to throw some lines up around the neck of the statue and pull it down using a 4x4. That's bad, because, you know, we have a piece on this by Robert Trzynski on the site today. Once you do that, and that's the law of the land, that's just authoritarianism. So who's to stop anybody from pulling down any statue anywhere? It's just a terrible, terrible thing to have happen. It is the way towards anarchy, and the people who are do this really ought to be rounded up and arrested and charged.
Well, I think so as well. And also, people need to understand that this is giving talking points and B-roll to the Trump campaign. David Burge, who what does he tweet under? What is his
Iowa Hawk
blog? He said, "A hero abolitionist who died fighting slavery in the Civil War and the female forward symbol of Wisconsin. Let's face it, the only thing you stupid Fs are accomplishing is providing free B-roll for Trump campaign commercials." Now, I understand that people will say, well, you guys shouldn't be focusing on this. You shouldn't talk about this. But you have to understand that in the alternative reality of the right, there's not a single conservative in America that is not hearing about these stories. This is not what's for them. This is the narrative.
And Trump will come
here, and he will say, when he comes to Wisconsin, he will say, "I alone can protect you against the looming chaos, you know, and the Visigoth hordes that are tearing down your statues in places like Wisconsin." And people in Brookfield, New Berlin, are going to say, "Yeah, we think you're awful, but we've seen this before."
You know, though, I have looked at how very, very smartly and how disciplined the Biden campaign has been. They did not lash themselves to the George Floyd protests, which I really do believe most presidential campaigns would have done. They would have looked at this and said, hey, there's a lot of energy here. I'm going to get out in front of it and wrap my arms around it and hug it close. Biden didn't do that for, I think, very smart tactical and possibly even smart philosophical reasons. When the defund the police thing came out and suddenly became this litmus test out of nowhere, Biden got way out in front of it and said, absolutely not. That's crazy. We want to reform the police. And so again, it's an opportunity for Biden to say, and I'm actually pretty confident he will take it, to say, no, this stuff is nonsense. These people are criminals. Mm-hmm. They should mm-hmm. be charged.
No.
And I have no, actually, very little doubt that Biden will do that. And I think it winds up, again, in a weird way, helping him with the types of indie voters who will look at this. Because again, it's just building that off-ramp, right?
For people
who once voted for Trump, who didn't feel bad about it, who were worried about having to vote for him again because they didn't want to be with Bernie Sanders or a socialist. And you start looking at Biden, and Biden is, again, just a normal kind of middle-of-the-road Dem.
This is the problem that Trump has with Biden, isn't it? That he wants to scare people that Joe Biden is this existential threat to America because he's going to open the door to all the lefties. And people look at Joe Biden and go, "Nah, not really. No, he's not that frightening." And Trump has that. There's that cognitive dissonance that he's either this senile, you know, old uncle who can't be trusted with anything, or he's Che Guevara. You have to choose at some point, don't you? I mean, there's a mixed message, and you can tell that Trump is having a hard time deciding. That's totally true.
Yeah. And the other problem is it isn't just that Biden isn't scary; it's that he's likable. And in almost every presidential election, the person who wins is the person who is more personally likable than the other guy. It is the classic, who would you rather sit down and have a beer with? And, you know, I mean, 2016 was a little weird because we had two wildly unpopular people. But Biden's just his favorability ratings, not even just, you know, the base favorability ratings for Trump. Like, you know, do you like him as a human being? He's, I want to say, 14 points underwater with Biden. And so Biden is, you know, he's a likable guy who represents pretty moderate politics, and he comes with a long, long track record, which basically says he's a grown up and he knows how to run the railroads and how to make government function. And it would have been hard for Trump to run against that even in good times, because in good times, people could have said, everything is basically fine. We can get rid of this guy we don't like and instead plug in a guy we do like. It becomes an even harder proposition at a moment when everything has gone to hell.
Well, that's true. So, you know, when Trump says Joe Biden is sleepy and he's slow and he's going to be boring, I think a lot of people are going to go, hey, I'm up for that. That's really, if you go for that, as opposed to this, just make it stop. So there is this new poll out today, the New York Times Siena poll, that has Biden up 14 points among registered voters. And Josh Krasauer has a piece out saying, you know, we may be looking at a landslide. Now, I of course, still suffer from the 2016 thing, so I don't think there's going to be a lot of irrational exuberance. But I want to get your take on all of this, because this is consistent with every poll that we're seeing, that Trump is just, you know, that even Republican-leaning groups are shifting away from Trump following the botched coronavirus pandemic. He's getting terrible numbers on dealing with the racial divide. Biden is winning 18 to 34-year-olds by 34 points, 35 to 49-year-olds by 23 points. They're basically even from voters 50 to 64. And Biden is actually winning 65 and older plus two. So, with the exception of white, no college voters, Biden's almost running the table, at least at the moment. So how do you see this?
So all races tighten, you know, down the stretch, even if they then spread out again in the last weeks or so. You know, as you move closer to the election, the races tighten. I suspect this will tighten as well. The natural dynamic seems to be, and has for over the course of a year now, been Biden plus six, Biden plus seven. Normally, when you look at the re-election of an incumbent, 50% is the marker, where if an incumbent is under 50%, it's real danger. That's where the political professionals start freaking out and saying, oh boy, you know, because again, undecided voters almost always break against the incumbent because they've seen him. They know what he is. And if you're not for him already, you're not going to suddenly become for him at the last minute. Trump is below 40%.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Not 50%, 40%. And the challenger is now in a number. It's not just this New York Times poll, but Biden is now at or above 50 in a whole bunch of polls. And anything can happen, sure. But if you were looking at the range of probable outcomes, the most probable outcome is going to be Biden wins by plus six to plus eight. There's a chance that Trump could get again, back to negative three and steal, but, you know, win an inside straight election in the Electoral College. But the flip side of just as likely as that is that Biden wins 400 electoral votes. There is almost zero chance that Trump has a shot to win the popular vote. That's gone. The idea that Trump could win the popular vote is simply an impossibility. That's 100-to-1 shot at this point. And so his best case scenario is threading the needle and getting 70,000 votes spread in precisely the right way again. And it just looks awfully, awfully hard. I mean, where does the, first of all, it's later than you think. This is
okay.
This
is an interesting point. As far as I can tell, you're the only one who's making this point. The cliche is, well, there's a long way to go. A lot of things can happen between now and November, and you're the contrarian on this.
Yeah, and I was the contrarian on this all through the primaries too. Everybody knows who these two guys are. Trump is so polarizing that the opinions of him among voters, it's just, again, just look at the data on this, are really locked in. People are really for him or really against him. There's very, very little room in the middle. And then you look at the actual dynamics of what's happening in the real world. Where is the good news for him? Where is the world in which suddenly things look fantastic again? For him, good news could look like 9% unemployment if everything goes really, really well. And that's still terrible. This, you know, the coronavirus does not go away. Maybe the protests go away. Maybe they don't. Who can say? You look at the world around us in terms of foreign affairs. Do we see anything about the world that could get better than it is right now? I don't think so. I think we're actually likely to see things get worse.
Well, in terms of the calendar, how many weekends are left? I think.
Yeah. So we're like 18 weekends. And right. Then you got to realize that, you know, so one of those weeks just goes away because of the Democratic convention. One of the weeks goes away because it's the Republican convention. One of the weeks goes away because it's Labor Day. And so as you start looking through and ticking it down, you realize, actually, hold on, wait a minute. We're not 18 weeks. We're closer to like 14 or 12 weeks away. So that is so, and don't forget also, he has to stop the slide first. So he's got to not only stop his backward momentum and stabilize and find a floor, but then he's going to have to make up at least 10 points. I'm not telling people that the race is over. I'm just saying that this is a very unlikely set of events. And if you were treating this purely as an odds making proposition where somebody said you have to bet $100 on an outcome, I think you'd be crazy to bet $100 on Trump getting to 270 electoral votes.
Okay, the Tulsa rally was supposed to be that turning point, right? He was going to stop the bleeding and he was going to begin going on the offense again. This was where he would essentially declare the pandemic is over. We are back. We're back doing the rallies. And now Hugh Hewitt says that we shouldn't read too much into the fact that only 6,000 people showed up, but it really did seem like an illusion buster, didn't it?
It did, and again it sucked up another weekend, right? This was the clock keeps ticking down, and you see this a lot of times in football, right? So a team is down by say 4 touchdowns, and you know they're like that at halftime, and then you think, well, they still have 2 quarters to come back, but with every possession that goes by where they don't make up ground, they're forced to do riskier and riskier things, which then increase the chances that things go even worse against them, right? You know, you're throwing too far downfield, you're trying to force it into double or triple coverage. And looking at Donald Trump, I mean, does anybody think that this guy is disciplined enough to think strategically and keep his eyes on the prize down the stretch? And no, of course not. And as things get worse for him, he will become even more erratic. And so I think that the nature of races is that this will tighten up a little bit at some point between now and September. But then you have the debates, right? And
maybe
honestly, the idea that like Trump is going to beat Biden in the debates is crazy to me.
Or that will make a difference. So I actually think there's a couple of tells. The fact that it was not only did the Tulsa rally not draw the kinds of crowds, but there was something kind of lifeless about his presentation. Again, his obsession with, you know, relitigating the walk down the ramp or the drinking of the water, which tells me, by the way, that folks from like the Lincoln Project are living in his head. I mean, some of their stuff, I think, has almost an audience of one, and I've kind of been a little skeptical of it. And I thought, no, they understand that they can suck an entire news cycle away from Trump by going at that vulnerable spot. He will take the bait. And as you point out, you know, each day, each news cycle is like, it's kind of a gold coin and you have to spend it. And every time, every one of those that Trump spends responding to one of the jibes from Project Lincoln, that's a win, the Lincoln Project. The other thing that really strikes me is how Trump's out of ammunition. He's out of material. So he's back touting the wall, and he's talking about criminalizing flag burning as if, okay, I got to go back through my old Rolodex to come up with the hot issues from 20 years ago and begin talking about it, because he's got nothing else.
Well, he has no, I mean, there is literally no vision for the campaign in the most literal sense. They don't even transition to greatness. It's like they left Jared in a room by himself for an hour to come up with, stringing four words that he thinks people in business school say together. There is no vision for the campaign. There is no affirmative vision for a second term of his presidency, which is something, whatever you want to say about it. Like he articulated a real vision for when he ran for president in 2016, his vision was, I'm going to build a wall, I'm going to burn it all down. And now he has burnt it all down and he has nothing left to say. And of course, he didn't build the wall either. And I look at the lay of the land here. You look at the calendar, you look at the numbers, Biden now eclipsing Trump in fundraising. Biden and Obama did $7 million on the virtual fundraiser they did the other night. The money is pouring in. Biden is a much better debater than Trump is. Where is the good news? Where is his pitch for what he wants to do? And the other thing is, this is the weird thing about Trump is when you go and look back at the 2016 campaign, he spent relatively little time attacking Hillary Clinton. Mostly it was talking about his vision for the future, right? We're going to build the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to beat up China. We're going to do all these things. He loves beating up on the media. He loves beating up on other Republicans. Beating up on Democrats, his heart has never really been in that because he doesn't really care about them. He doesn't care about Joe Biden. He has no real animus towards Joe Biden. The people he hates are the people he thinks are supposed to be loyal to him, but whom he deems insufficiently loyal. And so I just don't know that he's even going to be able to get it up to tear after Biden and drive Biden's negatives up the way that they think they are going to have to do if they're going to have a chance to win.
So talking about the campaign manager, Brad Parscale, is that the way you pronounce his name? I think I asked this.
I have no idea how you pronounce
okay,
his
well,
name.
Okay, we'll call it Brad. Brad Parscale.
Just call him Brad.
Brad. So how after Tulsa, you asked this question yesterday. How does he still have a job? Because, I mean, first of all, he's an over-promoted troll to begin with, right? I mean, for him to be the campaign manager for a candidate for president is, that's being out of your skis a little bit, right?
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, normally people who run campaigns at the presidential level are people who spent 20 or 30 years in practical politics, and they have managed campaigns of everything from state representatives up through senators or governors, and probably even done a failed presidential level campaign at some point. Yeah, and this guy, so this is Parscale's first campaign that he's managing.
Yeah.
And it happens to be a campaign for re-election of the president of the United States. It is the equivalent of America hiring Donald Trump to be president. Are we surprised that Brad doesn't know how to run a campaign any more than we're surprised that Donald Trump didn't know how to run a federal government? No, we shouldn't be.
Well, how is the Death Star working?
Yeah, the Death Star isn't great, is it?
Well, this was for people who were just checking in on this now. Brad Parscale announced, well, we are about to activate the Death Star, which is the massive data collection enterprise of the Trump campaign that was going to flood social media with all of this, whatever shit that they were going to put out. I think that one of the subtexts of what happened in Tulsa was that there's a couple of flaws in the Death Star.
Yeah. I have people who will forward me the actual come-ons they get from the Trump campaign over text message and what they see on social media and things delivered to their email inbox. And I got to say, it is some of the least sophisticated political advertising I've ever seen in my life. It is the political version of the Nigerian Prince email scams. Remember those, the 419 scams?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody did back in the early days of email and the internet. And it's stuff like, you know, "Dear Joe, you have been hand selected as one of only 100 patriots by President Trump himself. And we need you to take this survey, and then we're going to hand deliver your answers to the president, and they're going to help inform the policy choices he makes. Can you do this and give us $100?"
Yeah.
And I got to say, I mean, look, there are a lot of stupid people. There aren't that many people who are that stupid.
Well, we'll find out, won't we? This is a theme that runs through the Trump campaign, and actually the Trump presidency, is his really deeply held contempt for his own base. He really does think that they are dumb. I mean, he does think that he can just throw out the red meat. All he needs to do is walk over to a church and hold up the Bible, because that's what he needs to do for evangelicals, right? He figures that all he has to do is make flag burning an issue, and all the hard hats in America will cheer him. So, you know, it's not the left that thinks his supporters are deplorable as much as Trump himself thinks that they are that way. I mean, he's got this image in his head that all he need to do is throw this stuff out to, and, you know, use the lowest common denominator language and memes.
You know, in his defense, though, I mean, Trump doesn't know a whole lot of actual normal people, right?
Right.
I mean, he's a rich guy. He's from New York. He's president of the United States. How many normal people has he ever, you know, from Alabama, has he ever tripped over in the course of his life? The answer is probably, you could probably count them on one or two hands. The thing is, what he is deeply familiar with are the Conservatism Inc. avatars of those people. Guys like Jerry Falwell Jr. And honestly, if those are the only people from that part of the world who you ever met, then I'd have a pretty dim view of them too. Wouldn't you? I mean, because God knows he looks at Jerry Falwell Jr. and he has total contempt for this guy. And then he just extrapolates, "Oh, well, that's what all those people are really like."
I think that's true. I actually think that's true. All right. So speaking of which, he goes down to Arizona yesterday to speak to Charlie Kirk's group, which, by the way, I mean, you know, there's you could speak volumes right there that Charlie Kirk has become the voice of a new generation, at least in Trump world. No social distancing, no masks, plays the greatest hits again. I was really struck, though, by this, the sort of the split screen of Trump up there. He's sweating. He thinks that coronavirus is over. It's done. He's joking about why it's called COVID-19. He calls it the Kung Flu. You know, this is after he quote unquote joked down in Tulsa that our only problem was that we were testing too much, and he told people to slow down the testing. The split screen of Trump in Arizona, and then Anthony Fauci testifying saying, "Hey guys, this is not over." And we're starting to see these numbers from about half the states in the country showing that we're getting new peaks in the number of cases. Hospitalizations are up. So you have the president of the United States saying, "It's done. I've fixed it. Don't worry about it. You don't need to wear masks." And people like Anthony Fauci and even the governor of Texas saying, "Hey guys, this is still serious. It hasn't gone away. And people are dying. We're at 122,000 dead Americans." And
yeah, the numbers are really bad. This is, you know, one of the things I've kept pretty close track of. And we've seen over the last 2 weeks a real explosion in the number of cases. We have seen that accompanied by a rise in the positive test rate after touching what we had hoped was bottom. And if this is real, if we really are seeing a second wave, then in about 3 or 4 weeks, we're going to see the number of deaths starting to rise as well. And if that happens, those deaths are no longer going to be concentrated in New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. They're going to be in a bunch of red states. And what Republicans should care about is what this means for the Senate. Mm-hmm. You know, the numbers you talked about, in the very beginning of the New York Times poll, one of the numbers that was really eye-popping to people because it confirms something that we've been seeing for weeks now is that Biden is doing a lot better among older people, even older white folks. And I think this cannot be due to anything other than Trump and Republicans basically telling old people over the last 4 months that they should just die. and that keeping them alive doesn't matter. Now, there are a bunch of true believer Trumpers who are going to hold to that no matter what. But there's going to be some percentage of people who were marginal Trump supporters, marginal Republicans, who look at this and say, F that noise. I'm only 70. I got another good 15 years in front of me. I am not into this. And if that starts happening, again, with marginal R supporters in places where there are active Senate races, you know, like Arizona, like Colorado, I mean, how is that going to work? Because that's when you look at the total wipe, I was looking at it, if you remember, Kevin Williamson posted something like the day after Trump clinched the nomination. And he said, I'm just putting this here and I'm going to leave it. Remember that you people asked for this.
Yeah.
And if we do wind up in a giant Democratic blue wave and the Senate goes and everything else in what was, again, supposed to be a pretty good year for Republicans in terms of number of Senate seats up, the party could have its back broken. That's what nobody, I think, fully understands, that there is a level of which at where all of the, again, the marginally moderate Republicans, the people who should have been the future of the party, like Cory Gardner and Martha McSally, they're swept out. And the only people left are the super duper Trumpers. And with them as the owning the party, and Trump, even if he's no longer president, still sitting there tweeting and pretending that he owns the party and teasing that maybe he's going to run again and maybe he tries to install. But you could wind up having the Republican Party actually turned into sort of a rump party with, you know, yeah, some regional power, but who cannot compete on the national stage.
Well, though, that may not be the worst case scenario for a lot of them. Didn't you write about how losing is the new winning?
If your
party is about grievance, if politics is about expressing your feelings and your anger, aren't you even better off being out of office than in office?
Yeah, but I mean, there are a whole bunch of people in Conservative Inc. who, when they shook the hands of the devil here, they thought, well, we're going to be getting our policies, or at least I'll be able to further my own commercial interests. And I mean, all of that could go away. I'm not saying that's likely. I think it's probably unlikely. But there is, you know, I don't know, a 1 in 10 chance here that Trump breaks the Republican Party as a meaningful institution for a generation.
Well, I think so, too. And I've been warning about that for some time. Now, let's go back to the pandemic for a moment, what we're seeing here, because it feels like this has been a decisive turn. There was a moment in which America basically gave up on fighting the pandemic, right? When we start reopening and everybody goes, okay, Memorial Day weekend. I mean, I drove around Wisconsin and hardly saw any masks, and everybody is out, and, you know, restaurants are packed. Everybody is completely done with it, you know? And so Trump's theme was, okay, we beat this thing. We're coming back. And what we're finding out is that you can't just reopen America, right? That there are consequences to all of this, that the experts, you know, might not have been totally full of it. And so what you're seeing is, as this thing is spreading, you know that sooner or later, that's going to affect the economy. I'm doing this backwards. You can't reopen and restart the economy unless and until you've stopped the pandemic. It's obvious we have not stopped the pandemic. There are going to be tremendous economic consequences to all of that. And yet Trump and his acolytes are stuck now, aren't they? They are the prisoner of their own slogans and soundbites, which is that we've won this thing. He can't pivot again. He can't pivot to leading and protecting the country anymore.
You know, none of this ever made sense to me. When I looked at how Trump was handling the emergence of the virus, the only way to explain their positions was that they did not believe that reality was real, or they thought that they could just, you know, bullshit over top of it. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, like, oh, it's the lockdowns that are causing the economic pain was insane. The lockdowns didn't do anything. What caused the economic pain was the fact of the virus, right? Because the virus changes people's behaviors, whether or not the government says that you have to lock down. Now, you know, having a lockdown might exacerbate the economic impact a little bit, but the fact of the virus is the problem. And the idea that they were going to turn mitigation efforts into a culture war instead of leaning into the mitigation efforts and trying to really squash the virus as quick as possible just struck me as madness. I mean, madness both as a matter of public policy, but also as a matter of politics. And I think you're absolutely right. There is no way back for them. You know, Trump can't suddenly become Mr. You know what? We all got to wear masks now.
He can't do that. In fact, even if he did do that, he's already, put the word out that this is, that only, cowards and cucks do this sort of thing. So I don't know that he can come back on all of this. But, I think that's why when you think about what can happen between now and the election to make things better, if these numbers continue, the economy is going to suffer. The one thing that where he's not underwater is on his ratings on the economy, right?
Yes. So, which seems to be in large part due to the stimulus checks. He may send out, but not surprise me at all, actually, if they cut another set of $2,000 checks to everybody in America as we get closer to the election, which, by the way, might be the right policy. Frankly, I'm not saying that would not necessarily be good policy. It might be. I'd have to look at it closely. In general, I think the attempt that they had at stimulating the economy was deeply insufficient, and I'm in favor of the government spending more money here. But yeah, he could go back to that well again. But I got to think, as a political matter, that you get diminishing returns on that.
You would think so. I just don't see how. And plus, look, he was underwater in the polls when the economy was riding high. I mean, we really did have one of the best economies we've seen in a long time. I mean, the stock market was high. We had record low unemployment. All these things were going, and he was still only at 44%. So
yeah, he was minus six. This is why I said again, the natural state of this race is Biden plus six.
Okay.
But in all of the, in every, if you look at all of the scores of polls that have been taken on this race for going back a year now, even before Biden was a hypothetical, even before when his candidacy was hypothetical, before he was actually in the race, Trump has led Biden four times out of something like 160 polls or something like that. The natural state of this race is that he's going to lose.
Yeah. Okay. One other thing, though, that I tweeted about this morning, this fight over Twitter, which can't really figure out how to handle Donald Trump, put one of those little warnings on one of his tweets where he's talking about we will use maximum force or whatever to protect Washington D.C. and they decided that they needed to give you a trigger warning or something, which right. Silly in and of itself. So Michael Knowles tweets out, the president and Senate Republicans should use the full force of the federal government to destroy Twitter. Okay, just take a pause there. There's nothing conservative about permitting a big tech oligarch censor the duly elected POTUS for promising to enforce the law against devout insurrectionists. So I don't want to debate what Twitter did. It's just like, wow. I mean, do you remember when conservatives were all about stuff like freedom and small government and private enterprise? And now we have conservatives who want to use the full force of the federal government to destroy a private media company for something they said.
They're going to force Twitter to bake that cake, right? It was literally 5 minutes ago that the entire idea, animating idea of conservatism was that if you have two businesses in town and one business says, I don't want to make a cake for that because it contradicts my deeply held views, that you have to make a reasonable accommodation for it. And now they're like, well, sorry, bring in the tanks. Have the National Guard stand around the baker. Make sure they bake the cake.
No, I mean, it really is. We're at a moment where the conservative movement is really... There's no way you can define what it's for any longer. Now, it's very clear what they're against. This is where I think there's some hope for the conservative movement after Trump. And I don't mean that quote unquote hope, which is that they will devolve to what they do best, which is to be reactionary. And I mean that in a descriptive term, which is that you know that the left will overreach, will do a variety of things, because there's no way that you can define conservative values that aren't being violated on just a regular basis. We stand for the First Amendment. Well, not really. A small government. Well, really, not really. Federalism. Forget about it. Character. Not so much. So what? We want conservative judges who will do what? Give us the results. That's the other thing, by the way. Have you noticed how conservatives are already more from, we don't want judges who are going to read the Constitution. We want judges who will vote the way we want them to vote. So much for the independent judiciary thing.
It's really something. I'm actually looking forward to the first time that we get some Biden appointee somewhere who didn't pay taxes on their illegal nanny or something like that. And conservatives suddenly start deciding that character counts again. And that, you know, this is the greatest outrage in the history of American self-governance. And how dare he? And blah, 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 blah.
Yeah,
blah, blah.
Exactly. Okay, so let's put out a pitch for our newsletters, because we want to thank all the loyal listeners of the podcast who've really made it the success. And we're going to have, this will be our biggest month ever for downloads of the podcast. And thank you for that. And also for reading all the stuff that we put on the Bulwark site. But Jayville, you, me, Jim Swift, we also put out daily newsletters. And, you know, that's been a lot of fun. And also the more that I think about it, the more I think that the new forms of communication, you know, are really, you know, have changed the way that people in the media interact with their readers and their listeners. And this is one of the things that, if you have not signed up for our newsletters, you really ought to do it, because you know what the best thing about them? And JBL, you know what the best thing about our newsletters is, right?
For free.
They're absolutely, I didn't even prep you on that. They're absolutely for free. We have no paywall. You don't have to pay anything. They just come into your inbox and you get all of that wit, snark, and information right there.
Yeah, they're pretty good, actually. And the thing I mean, selfishly, I would say this, they're all wildly different.
Yes.
I mean, and people can pick and choose. You don't have to take all three of them. Yeah. You can like Charlie and Jim and not like me and only take those two newsletters. But yeah, no, they're really differentiated products. And I don't know, I'm pretty proud of them, honestly. I didn't start these out thinking all that deeply about how they would evolve, but I've been super proud of the way they've turned out over the last year and a half. It's been a year and a half. Do you realize that?
No, I know. It's amazing. It only feels like about 20 years.
I know.
I mean, that is, well, like the last 3 months has felt like 20 years. That's the amazing thing, is if you go back and you look at what 3 months ago, there was a moment a couple of weeks ago when I'm looking, you realize that 3 months ago, we were absolutely sure that Bernie Sanders was going to be the nominee and Joe Biden was really cold product. And it was,
yeah.
3 months later, it's, you know, the world has changed. But I do think that we're in this amazing moment, and I think we've really been lucky to be in this amazing moment. But if you want to keep up to date, and obviously if you're listening to this podcast, you are one of those people who want to keep up to date with what's going on, which is why we do this podcast every single day, and we put out the newsletters every single day, every weekday. And I've started putting out a newsletter over the weekends just of reader email, because we get so much email and people seem to like that as well.
So much email.
God, yeah.
I mean, email, which is great. Honestly, I've become friends with a bunch of our readers, which is really cool. And I started to get a lot of story tips too. I mentioned how people send stuff to me. I've had some people actually inside the Trump campaign send me things as well. It's nice. You know, it turns out when you build an operation to tell people what you actually think and you don't really care about, you know, getting a seat at the table in the Republican Party going forward or garbage like that, people will find you.
Well, and I think one of the things is people like about when they see the other email, when they see the comments of the other readers, is they think, hey, this is a club I want to be part of, because they realize that we have a really unique set of people who listen to us, read us, follow us on a regular basis. So we want to thank all of you for that. JBL, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. As usual, we appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Charlie. Feel better, man.
I'm working on it. I'm working on the hand. The fact that I can hold a microphone in my hand is a sign of real progress. Now, I think by tomorrow I'll be able to actually button my own shirts and do things like that, which is hard to do if you only have one hand. So thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.